of the state of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. Before we start, Council, I just have a couple of announcements. We are welcoming today several classes. We have students from West Allis Central High School. Would they please stand? Welcome. You may be seated. We have students from Cambria Friesland. Would they stand? Good seeing you. Thank you. And we have students from Lancaster High School. Would they stand? It's good seeing all of you. You may be seated. The students are with us today with our Court with Class program. That program is a national award-winning program that's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. And students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. They have been given materials about the case, including briefs, and they may have done extra work inside the class to study about this case. And then the students will meet at noon with a justice of the court to discuss the procedures, and everyone is invited to attend that discussion at noon. In just a few moments, an alarm will go off, which will sound awful, and if it works the way it usually does, some blue lights will flash in this chamber, but it is only a testing of the alarm system. So everyone should remain seated. So that's where we are now. If anyone here has not received material about this case, there's a description of the case. Well, the alarm system works, and that's good. So the next step before we start the case is for me to introduce the court to all of you, because we've met you. On my far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks, and you will meet with Justice Crooks after this case ends. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I will now call our first and only case this morning, 00-2426, In re the Commitment of Gregory J. Franklin, State versus Franklin. Representing Mr. Franklin is Patrick M. Donnelly of the State Public Defender's Office in Madison. Mr. Donnelly.
Members of the court, Ms. Wellman, good morning. As Justice Abramson explained, my name is Pat Donnelly, and I represent Mr. Franklin.
You just move your microphone closer so we can hear you better.
I have to apologize. I have a slight chest cold, and my normally indistinguished voice is even more so this morning. As I understand the question before the court today and the petition that was granted by this court, the question that is to be answered is, what is the applicable rule for the admission of other acts evidence in Chapter 980 commitment proceedings? And after reading the Court of Appeals opinion in this case that was issued, particularly the concurrence by Judge Fine, I think the issue could be fairly characterized in another manner, with the question being posed, is the admission of other acts evidence in a Chapter 980 proceeding to be dealt with in a manner unlike any other proceeding in Wisconsin jurisprudence, whether it be a civil or a criminal proceeding? Mr. Franklin would argue to this court that there should not be a different set of rules for the admission of other acts evidence in Chapter 980 proceedings.
I am having trouble hearing you. This should not be what?
There should not be a different set of rules applied in Chapter 980 proceedings for the admission of other acts evidence.
Okay. But we do have an issue that the other acts evidence is generally used or misused to show that because the defendant has had prior convictions or prior misdeeds, that these misdeeds go to plan, motive, et cetera, intent, to show that that was effective for commission of the crime for which the state now seeks a conviction, right?
Correct.
And in this case, the prior act evidence is used for what purpose?
At the time Judge Maroney admitted this evidence, Judge Maroney, I think, attempted to apply the standards in 90404 sub 2 and reasoned that this evidence was admissible because it had some relationship to the elements in a Chapter 980 case. As I obviously argued in my brief, I agree with the analysis to the extent that Judge Maroney applied the 90404 rules. I disagree with the conclusion he reached in this case in terms of the admissibility, primarily based on my belief that the evidence that came in through the probation agent in this case was not relevant to the elements that are required for a showing of a commitment in a Chapter 980 case.
Well, here, Mr. Donnelly, does that mean then that you would favor the approach that Judge Curley took, not her conclusion, but the approach that she took applying the Sullivan three-part test?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And tell us why.
It's my belief that other acts evidence in a Chapter 980 case can be admitted in two different ways, or could be brought up in two different ways. One would be that it is directly related to an element in the case, one of the elements of 980. That is, it has to do with the predisposition to commit acts of sexual violence.
Can you slow down a little, please?
I will attempt to.
Because I'm having difficulty in hearing. That might help.
My apologies.
It's not your fault. It's our system. Please don't apologize.
I would note that in this record, I think there's a perfect example of how 90404 should work in this case, and it's State versus Hungerford, which was a case that this court ruled on. And in that instance, it was an analysis of the admission of prior sexual acts in the old Chapter 975 Sex Crimes Commitment Act. And what this court reasoned in that case was that under motive and intent, prior acts of sexual misconduct were admissible at trial in the context of that case because it tended to prove the elements necessary for a Chapter 975 commitment in terms of predicting dangerousness. And I think that's exactly the rule that needs to be applied in Chapter 980 cases. The concern I had with the opinion that was issued by Judge Fine in particular, I think it created a rule without parameters. There was no reasoning or analysis necessary to determine relevancy. And one of the issues I have in particular is the reasoning that Chapter 980 is different because 90404 sub 2 is most appropriately applied in criminal cases.
Well, Mr. Donnelly, didn't Judge Fine put a lot of emphasis on the word acted in 904.042? And doesn't that make sense? Isn't the focus very different in 904.042 because of that word acted?
I would agree with that analysis if the law that that has developed since this court enacted the rules of evidence some 30 years ago had not focused this particular statute on propensity in general. That is, the propensity evidence is not admissible, and I would submit that that reasoning would apply whether it's to show someone acted in conformity with a past act or acted in conformity with an act that is potentially to exist in the future. One thing I would like to point out that I was going to point out just before I got to this point was the reasoning that these cases should be treated differently because 90404 is most appropriate in criminal cases, I think, is difficult to reconcile with Chapter 980 itself, and particularly in Section 980.05 sub 1M, which deals with the context that trials are to be conducted in Chapter 980. 1M reads, at trial, to determine whether the person who is subject of the petition under Section 980.02 is a sexually violent person, all rules of evidence in criminal actions apply. And I have a difficult time reconciling that clear legislative intent with the reasoning that Chapter 980 cases should be dealt with differently because they're not criminal cases.
Perhaps the reason is because everything in Chapter 904 doesn't apply. I mean, why shouldn't we look at this as simply a 904.05.2 issue where, you know, a particular trait is what may cause someone to be sexually dangerous in the future, and why isn't past evidence as a behavior something we should look at in regarding what might be the future behavior?
Well, I would agree that under 90405 that certain specific instances of past conduct are admissible in these cases, but it has to be related to the elements of the offense. And I would submit that it's fairly obvious and easy to conclude that in most instances, acts of prior sexual violence in all likelihood is related to one of the elements of 980.
But isn't part of it the uncontrollability or the unpredictability of when this person may act in an inappropriate way, and isn't then his label as being uncontrollable in other circumstances probative of that question?
Well, I would point out that there's a very serious distinction to be drawn here that in the requirement of proof in a 980 case, and that is it's not required to show that a person is dangerous and mentally ill. It's required to show that the person is dangerous because they're mentally ill. And my fear is that unless it can be directly related to proof of a mental illness, the relevance of some 109, for instance, specified nonspecific prior acts of misconduct in the institution, for instance, without any explanation what is behind those misconduct reports that are necessarily layered with all types of levels of hearsay, will not be put to use by a jury to determine whether or not their mental illness causes them to have a propensity for committing acts of sexual violence. They will conclude that the person is simply dangerous and better safe than sorry. Whether or not the person's mental illness causes the dangerousness, it's better to commit that person.
Counsel, I'm going to just change the direction for a minute, but as I read the record here now, both experts, first of all, under 90401, we're talking about relevancy, the defense expert clearly relied on these non-sexual priors. In other words, I assume that both psychiatrists, for the purpose of evaluating to see whether this person was mentally ill, had schizophrenia. Now, how do you separate that? In other words, the jury knew that. They heard from your expert as to these non-priors. In other words, as to the non-sexual priors. In other words, all of the 100 and whatever you said.
I don't know if I would agree with the court that this expert said he specifically relied on that information. I believe the testimony was that he considered that information.
Yes, when they did their static psychological evaluation, they relied on this whole history.
And to the extent that I think that's perfectly appropriate direct examination of an expert, I don't have a problem with on direct examination, either party asking their expert, did you rely on the records of the Department of Corrections? Yes, I did. That does not open the door to allow the proponent of that evidence to get into the details or the basis of those documents without some showing that there's an exception to the rules of evidence that would allow for the admission of that information. If I may, I think there was at one point in this trial where there was a perfect example of the admission of other acts evidence that came from the Department of Corrections records on cross-examination of the defense expert. And had to do with the diagnosis of paraphilia. And the defense expert had concluded that Mr. Franklin did not suffer from paraphilia. The state then had, I think on the direct examination, the DSM requirements for paraphilia had been described for the fact finder. And in an attempt to undermine the defense expert, the state cross-examined the expert on specific instances of conduct in the institution that may have supported the conclusion that Mr. Franklin did suffer from a paraphilic disorder. And I think that was perfectly appropriate in the context of cross-examination. But what we have in this case is an anticipatory admission of all this evidence before any expert had testified in this case. The agent was allowed to come to the stand and describe these incidences without having shown any link or nexus at this point in the trial why this information was necessary.
Are you finished, first of all? If not, please finish.
I was going to take a different direction, but that can wait.
I want two things. I want, number one, to make sure I understand your argument, and number two, I want you to play out your analysis with a specific prior conviction. So, number one, I think your argument is this, that 90404 sub 2 works in this case as it does in other cases, and you look to the statutory authority that you pointed to that says all criminal rules of evidence apply in 980. Okay. But where you part company with Judge Curley and where you part company with the trial court is that you think that some of this evidence is not relevant. The trial court did its analysis based solely on relevance. Judge Curley did the analysis and then, you know, the probative value stuff. Judge Curley did it under 90404 sub 2, but in applying the three-pronged Sullivan test, you have to find out if it's relevant. That's one of the steps of the inquiry. And so at the end of the day, your whole argument really is this is not, some of this evidence is not relevant. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, let's take a piece of evidence. A theft of a jewelry store is one of the prior convictions. Work me through the analysis of why that's inadmissible.
Well, the elements of 980 require, one, that the individual suffer from a mental disorder that predisposes them to committing acts of sexual violence. And secondly, that mental disease or disorder creates a substantial probability of a danger that they will commit those acts in the future. So I would propose that you would look at this specific instance of conduct to see whether or not it fits any exception within 90404 sub 2 for the exclusion of other acts evidence. As a starting point, it's excluded under 90404.
That's not, as I recall, the way you approached it in your brief. It doesn't mean you have to, but I mean, I was expecting you to say as a starting point.
I would say 90401 becomes part of the analysis of 90404. And it's difficult to separate that out. I did take the position, and I still take the position, that up front, that the first thing that should be determined is whether or not this evidence was relevant. And I don't believe it was. I should explain to the court that I got into this case late. I did not do the briefing in the Court of Appeals. I may have taken a different approach in the Court of Appeals and argued strictly relevance, because I don't think it passes muster on relevance related to the elements of the offense.
And relevance, as you set forth in your brief, is part of the Sullivan three-prong test, right, under 90404.
That's correct.
But walk me through it. Why isn't this admissible? I mean, why isn't theft of a jewelry store prior conviction, why can't everyone hear about that in the trial?
Because it's not related to the matter that's before the trier of fact. The danger is that the prejudice that is accrued the subject of the commitment proceeding in a 980, is far outweighs any relevant, any possible relevance that it could have.
About relevance, you have to say relevant to what? And there are two issues that it might be relevant to. One, is there a probability that he will commit sexual acts in the future? That's one, right?
Yes.
The second, if I understand from your briefs and your conversation here today, is does his do his past acts show a mental illness? Because you've got to prove, the state has to show a mental illness here, right?
I wouldn't say that the past acts have to show a mental illness. I would say that.
I mean, they could be relevant.
They could be. Certainly they could be. There certainly could be instances totally unrelated to sexual conduct that are relevant.
But you have to show a mental illness here, right?
Correct.
Okay. So you got two issues. Is there a third or fourth issue to which past conduct might be relevant in a 980 proceeding?
I would say that under 90404, as in Hungerford, if it could be shown on a case-by-case basis, depending upon the facts of the case, if it's related to motive or intent or one of the other exceptions under 90404, it would be admissible.
But we're dealing with 980. How does motive, intent, plan fit with 980? Maybe that's not what
you're trying. No, but that's okay.
I think it's a very tenuous link.
Okay.
And I would
say that's why you don't think 90404 applies here.
I think it applies in instances where the other acts are not related to one of the elements.
Let's do the, as the Chief started, what are the elements of the 980? There is, you have to show a mental, well, let's just take the two out of the three that you talked about. Mental illness, and that a substantial likelihood, or whatever the language is, that there will be future sexual acts. Okay. How does theft of a jewelry store, how is it relevant to an element that you have to prove? Work me through that analysis. You'd say, how is it relevant? Well, first of all, relevant to what? To those two things. Now, how is it more likely to show
the only potential relevance I can see in the context of those two elements is it could go to dangerousness generally, just that this person is a dangerous person. He has a propensity to do dangerous things, but not as a result of a mental disease or disorder, simply because he's predisposed to criminal conduct or antisocial conduct. But in order to be relevant, it has to be shown somehow that it's related to, for instance, well, it could be considered as a general basis for the doctor's opinion that the person suffers from a mental disorder, qualifying mental disorder in 980. But that does not necessarily mean that the fact finder gets to hear the details.
It doesn't mean it's admissible. That's what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I'm still getting back to it's relevant, and relevant to what? Now, this fella is diagnosed with paraphilia and schizophrenia. He's not diagnosed as a mental illness with antisocial behavior, unlike some other cases that are cited in the briefs, right?
Correct.
So is it relevant to that he will commit future acts of sexual aggression Is theft of a jewelry store relevant to that?
No.
Is theft of a jewelry store relevant to a mental illness of paraphilia, showing paraphilia, or is it relevant to showing a mental illness of schizophrenia?
No, not on the record before this court.
But what is it relevant to? And then once you get a relevance, then you have to find, you know, that's the step before admissible. But first of all, what is it relevant to?
Counsel, I have a question for you. His paraphilia is based on non-consent. So what he's fixated on is doing things for which he doesn't have consent. He's incarcerated for doing sexual things he doesn't have consent. But why isn't stealing from a jewelry store? Certainly you didn't have the consent of the person that owned the store. Why isn't that relevant to his paraphilia?
Without the nexus being shown that it's related to the mental disorder that would prove the propensity. For instance, if in that instance that act sexually aroused this individual, then it may be relevant. But if it didn't sexually arouse this individual, if what he did, as in the instance in this case, he said he stole because he needed the money, it does nothing to prove whether or not this person has a propensity to commit sexual
right, but
violence.
Part of his propensity problem is non-consent. In other words, he tends to attack people that don't want his advances. Well, to me, there does seem to be a nexus with the paraphilia and his robbing a jewelry store, because he didn't have the consent. He may have needed the money. Well, maybe he had some other motives for his sexual advances as well. But by the same token, they were both acts taken without the consent of the person that was involved on the other side of the act.
Well, with all due respect, I find that to be a risky position to take, because it lays in our laps, lay people, the difficult task of speculating on what that link would be to their mental disorder.
But weren't these things that were relied upon by both of the experts that examined him? One found paraphilia, the other one did not. But aren't these the same type of things that they relied on?
They certainly considered everything they could get their hands on.
Right.
And that does not mean that everything becomes admissible because they happen to review it. I would hope that the example I drew about the cross-examination of paraphilia shows what the proper limitation is on the introduction of that type of evidence. Otherwise, if what the rule is everything that a person does in their life is admissible, I would submit under Judge Fine's reasoning, he certainly didn't limit it to all things negative the person did in their lifetime, then it may well be that there's a countervailing view that because he got 5 merit badges when he was a child along with his juvenile record, that becomes relevant too in that balance. And what you will soon have are both sides of a litigation like this getting as much stuff in front of the experts as they can, and you've got this battle of good person, bad person going on at trial.
Yeah, but the experts, before they come to trial, review all this information, and they either decide that it has some bearing on their diagnoses or it does not. And paraphilia takes many forms. His particular form is non-consent. That's what he's basically focused on. So I don't know why the lawyer, if this information was given to the expert, couldn't cross-examine the expert, and even given that the expert said, yes, you know, this was based on non-consent, but it doesn't have any relevance because this type of non-consent is not relevant. But I don't believe that's in the record.
Well, I would disagree that is not in the record. I had been under the impression that Dr. Doran had specifically discussed those prior acts of sexual violence that were non-consent as the basis for his diagnosis of paraphilia. He certainly didn't...
I'm talking about the jewelry store, things that aren't sexually focused. That's what I'm looking at.
Well, I guess that would be no different than suggesting that someone observed Mr. Franklin at a stoplight and he ignored the don't walk sign. He walked without consent.
Well, I think that's
you have to decide where the... Well, obviously that's...
A lot of people walk without the walk sign, but they don't rob jewelry stores.
It's certainly hyperbolic, but it's a natural extension of that argument. Unless a link can be shown to the diagnosis of a mental disorder that causes the dangerousness, the prior act really has no relevance.
Could I ask you, Mr. Donnelly, whether a jury could find, although I don't suppose they'd state it explicitly, that Mr. Franklin had an antisocial personality disorder?
Could the jury find that in spite of the fact that neither doctor diagnosed it? I think that's a potential can of worms. I think this court sort of tangentially addressed that issue in the Keenitz case. I would argue quite strenuously no, that there are certain types of actions, and I had some cases that I had intended to cite, but I got a red light here, that are just so complex that what you end up with in a case like this is jurors speculating about a mental disorder, making a diagnosis of their own, independent of an expert witness. And I think that's a very dangerous prospect.
How would we know whether they had decided that or not?
I suspect in an instance where the state had submitted that the person suffered from an antisocial personality disorder, and that was the qualifying disorder, and there was no expert who testified, or, for instance, there was no expert at all called, that you would certainly be sure that the jury is the one who made the diagnosis. I guess the question really would be, could the state proceed in a proceeding such as this, or a Chapter 51, without expert testimony? I guess if jurors are left to make their own diagnosis, they can. I see my time is up.
Donnelly, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Wellman, Assistant Attorney General.
Thank you. Good morning.
In the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you. And may it please the Court, I am Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state on oral argument in this case. The state asked this court to hold that in a Chapter 980 commitment case, the state is not precluded from offering other crimes or other acts evidence by the person who's the subject of the proceeding to prove that he has a mental disorder that predisposes him to engage in sexual violent acts, and or to prove that his disorder creates a substantial probability that he will engage in such acts. We believe that the most correct analysis is that other crimes evidence, whether it's sexual or non-sexual, simply be analyzed under 90401 and 90403 for relevance and prejudice.
Say that again. I know you said 901, the first two things, but that's your position? It all should be or should not
it
be?
It should be analyzed simply for relevance and prejudice versus probative value, not under the 904.04 sub 2 analysis.
What difference does it make?
In result, probably not much, because as Judge Curley did in this case, if you try to fit it in for another proper purpose, another proper purpose will be to prove the mental disorder or the substantial risk of reoffense. The problem I have is, one, that the language of the statute itself says you can't use it to prove he acted, past tense, in conformity.
I have that problem, too. And so to that extent, I thought, well, you know, Judge Fine was, let me say, half right. but what do you do with 980... 051M, all rules of evidence in criminal actions apply. How do you get around that?
Well, I don't have a problem with that because we're not saying that it doesn't apply because it's 980. We're saying it doesn't apply because of the nature of the question. For example, in a 980 case, suppose you had other crimes evidence of one of the doctors, that he was on the take, and he would always give the state the right answer if he got a promotion at the institution or something. And you'd shown he could show he did that in 29 prior 980 cases. Well, that might be other crimes evidence of that witness that you would be offering to show he acted in conformity when he gave this opinion. But that's just not what it's being offered for here. It's no different than the guardianship cases that we cited in our brief or anything where you're predicting the future. It could be a criminal case, a civil case, a mental commitment case. It's not whether the rule applies, really. It's whether the exclusion applies within the rule. And if the exclusion doesn't apply, then you just don't have to go into the box of 90404. And, you know, part of my reluctance, frankly, is the case law suggests in criminal cases that we have enough trouble in criminal cases keeping out propensity evidence that shouldn't be used for propensity in criminal cases or misused. And I just think that it'll be confusing to be saying, well, sometimes propensity fits in this 90402 sub 2 box, the second sentence, when the real issue is, no, if you're trying to prove liability or guilt for the past, you know, then you have to go through all of the hoops of 90404 sub 2. But if you're looking to the future, this is about propensity. It's about likelihood of reoffense. It's a different question. I agree. Most of the time, the result won't be different. But I think the analysis is important. And the key here, of course, under either one is relevancy. And in a sense, we're going to do the same analysis. You're just going to skip step one of Sullivan, I think, and go to step two, which is it relevant? Does it go to a fact of consequence? We look at the elements of 980. And does it have probative value as to that? Does it have any tendency to make it more or less likely?
You remember the Watson case?
Oh, my, yes.
Well, you argued the Watson case.
Yes, I did.
Now, you recall in that case, we did not have a per se offense that was sexually motivated. You had to prove that false imprisonment
Correct.
Was sexually motivated. That would have been done both at trial and in a preliminary examination. Now, if you relied on other acts evidence to show that that false imprisonment was sexually motivated, wouldn't you then be applying 90404 sub 2 in the traditional way?
You might in that instance. I had not thought of that, but that might be one of the rare ones where you would, because you're still showing something about the past predicate act that's necessary to the statute. But once you took off from there and said, is he likely to commit other crimes of sexual violence, including sexually motivated false imprisonment, then you would bounce back to just doing the relevancy and probative prejudice.
Going back to the Watson case, is hearsay an issue in this case?
Well, it's not in this case because it was not raised in the Court of Appeals as an issue. It wasn't raised in the petition for review. This court didn't grant the petition for review on it, and it hasn't been fully briefed by the parties. That being said, and I think the record is a real problem in this case because the objections at trial were extremely vague. And defense counsel said, well, I think the court should narrow what comes in through this agent. And then he said, well, I want a continuing objection. So, even in the brief, I can't tell exactly what statement by the agent or what piece of evidence Mr. Franklin is objecting to on hearsay grounds, and that's critical. Having said that, I think, you know, there certainly are arguments to be made that all of the testimony by the probation or parole agent comes in under a hearsay exception.
What hearsay exception is that?
Well, one of them would be 90803 sub 6 and sub 8, which are recorded public records and
past recollection recorded.
It's
business
not past
records
exception. Recorded, yeah. And I think under the pre-sentence investigations, I think should come in under the residual exception, which is 90803.24, because the report itself has substantial guarantees of trustworthiness. It's to be done by a neutral party. It is done by a neutral party. The court uses it to sentence. DOC uses it to program and plan. In a repeater allegation, unless it's disputed, it's prima facie evidence of the prior crimes. Now, within the PSI, there may be other statements, and that's what was at issue in Watson. There was a statement by the victim that appeared nowhere else, and that went to another level of hearsay. But in this case, most of what the agent talked about was just paper record. You call up his juvenile record on whatever CCAP or something, and you've got this, and that she put it in the report.
But interestingly, you did not respond that it is admissible because an expert relied on it.
Well, it's admissible for both, but there's two different things going on. If it's admissible, if the court in its discretion can let it in because the expert relied on it, but then upon the request, the defense would be entitled to an instruction that it only goes to credibility.
I want to say exactly, but I want to step back because you answered it quickly.
Sorry.
Do you agree that just because an expert relies on something does not mean that the underlying data, which is the basis of the expert's opinion, is admissible?
As substantive evidence, yes,
substantive
I agree.
Substantive evidence. And so the idea that just because you remember the perhaps the Bagnowski case, maybe not, in the late 80s, which took the position that expert testimony, if the judge relies on it, that the expert testimony statute, anything you relied on was a hearsay exception,
oh, okay.
And everything was in. And then there were seminars on this. Judicial counsel came up with a proposal to correct that decision. And finally, we had the Copland decision maybe in the early 90s that said, hey, listen, no, just because they rely on it doesn't mean that it's admissible. And then the Weber decision. But there seemed to be some confusion in the Court of Appeals decisions here that just because an expert relies on it, that it is admissible, and that is not a correct statement of the law. Do you agree?
Correct. If you're only using it to assess the expert's credibility, you don't have to fit it into a hearsay exception. But if it comes in under a hearsay exception, also a standalone direct substantive testimony,
then it's admissible.
Right. And here the defense never asked for limiting instruction. I mean, I guess we're going to go off in that direction. You know, I would like to have a rebriefing on the hearsay issues because I think we can't do justice to them here.
If we can get on to the hearsay. You say that the PSI and everything that the agent testified to are in records, trustworthy records. But it's the same thing that we're talking about with the expert witness of what they rely on. Just because it's in a record that's trustworthy doesn't mean that that whole record can be introduced. It still has to be relevant.
Oh, right.
And so whether the agent had all of this information, and nobody's questioning that it's accurate. No one's saying he wasn't found guilty. No one's challenging these convictions. The fact that they're in this record does not make them admissible. It doesn't make the testimony admissible. You still have to find relevance.
Right, and that's the other thing I did want to make clear, is relevancy is one whole issue, and it's over here. Hearsay is another issue. I mean, the evidence can be extremely relevant, but inadmissible hearsay. Okay. It could be admissible under the most clear hearsay exception and extremely irrelevant to a particular case. So we have to keep those two separate. But to discuss relevancy, would you like me to move on?
Back to relevancy, and sure. I want to know how it fits to mental disorder and substantial risk of a sexual offense. Before you do that, we all agree, don't we? Maybe we don't. That because a person's dangerous, because he's antisocial, because he's a bad actor, because the chances are he's going to rob a jewelry store again when he gets out, we agree we cannot keep him beyond his term for those reasons.
Not under Chapter 980, right. Right. I mean, we don't have a statute that permits that.
We don't have any other statute that's going to do
right.
that, so unless you can get him in under institutionalization for mental disease or disorder, he's out on the street.
Right.
So if the state wants to keep him after he's served his full term, under the laws, they have got to find a mental disorder that predisposes to sexual acts and a substantial risk of a sexual offense.
Correct.
Okay. How does the robbery or burglary of a jewelry store fit? How is that relevant to those two factors?
Well, in this case, it's relevant in three different ways, actually, to three different disorders, and it's also relevant to risk. First, it's relevant to schizophrenia, because both doctors diagnosed this man with schizophrenia. And Dr. Lodal in particular, although I think Doran also agreed with him, said if you look at all of his underlying pattern of misbehavior since he was a young adult, or, you know, a teenager, that all fits part of the pattern of the schizophrenia. So it supports that diagnosis.
That was the point I was had asked opposing counsel when the expert used it to prove the very mental disorder. So you can continue. But I think, isn't there a difference between the proving of that disorder and what the ultimate is? His potential for reoffending here?
Right. They're two different issues. It also is very, very relevant to the antisocial personality disorder diagnosis. Both doctors found that he met all of the criteria, or sufficient criteria. You don't have to meet all of them. You have to meet a certain number of criteria, and he met those. And the only reason they didn't officially diagnose it was because they didn't feel they had enough information to say any of his antisocial behavior was when he was not in an active schizophrenic state. The jury, however, is the ultimate fact finder, and it's our position that hearing all of the testimony, the jury could have concluded, we believe the state has proved he has antisocial personality disorder.
That seems to me to be a dangerous position for you to take, because what you're saying has implications for the run-of-the-mill, the mine run auto accident on the corner of Main and 3rd Street. You're saying you can have a neurologist testify that he has a problem in C7, and you can have an orthopedic surgeon testify, no, the problem is in the thoracic area, but the jury really says, no, it's a lumbar disc. If both doctors say, you know, we considered lumbar disc, and it doesn't really seem like, because not everything is there. I think it's cervical. The other one says, I think it's thoracic. And the jury can come back with the kind of injuries that are associated with the lumbar disc. Is that what you're saying?
You know, I don't know enough about civil cases, frankly, to know if there's some case law out there that says they absolutely cannot do that. But assuming that there isn't, or it's not applicable here, I don't know of anything in the 980 arena that says no.
But that's not what you were arguing. You were answering, as I understood it. You know, maybe I misheard or something. Who knows? Or I misunderstand. But I thought you were advancing the proposition that a jury can come up with its own opinion that requires expert testimony, not based on any expert testimony.
Well, I don't know if I would go that far, but where they have expert testimony and they find insufficient the doctor's reason for saying, I would find him diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder but for this one thing, and they don't find that but for to be credible or sufficiently supported, then I think it is within their realm.
And they can diagnose, they can come with the conclusion that he's antisocial. Let's say they didn't hear that antisocial is out of it. Now, see, I think if antisocial was in it, then a lot of this, in my thought process, a lot of this naughtiness in his past behavior is in. But just is admissible, you know. But paraphilia, you know, just because people do things without consent, I mean, I don't tell my kids, but I think they would all be sex predators if that was the, you know, the kind of testimony that occasioned someone to believe that you're a sex predator. And, you know, I mean, they're almost perfect, but there are occasions they did things without consent. And I'm not sure, you know, I just don't follow that nexus.
Well, in the, you know, in the paraphilia, I mean, there's obviously more than just non-consent. There's sexual arousal to the non-consent. And I don't know that we have this here, but we do have firm evidence by both doctors that the antisocial personality disorder heightens risk. And even Dr. Doran, who found that he was schizophrenic but found that schizophrenia was not a predisposing diagnosis, said it can, however, like alcohol abuse, heighten his risk. So those are relevant factors to risk, even if you take antisocial as a diagnosis and schizophrenia as a diagnosis out. It's also relevant, I think, to the credibility of Dr. Doran, because he explained why he found paraphilia. The other expert didn't find paraphilia. He said, one of the things I looked at was his behavior from the time he first got in trouble as a kid through young adulthood to see does he have a pattern of just overall criminality, which would not be suggestive of this drive of paraphilia, or is there really a drive there? And he said, I looked at those, and I decided that given that all of his recent offenses are all sexual assaults and follow a similar pattern, and there's proof he was sexually aroused in each one. And he did it even though the chance of getting caught was very, very great, and he was on supervision, and he knew the consequences. All those things showed, in spite of that other non-sexual history, I came to the conclusion, to a reasonable degree of professional certainty, that he has paraphilia. That evidence was relevant to support how he got to the diagnosis he got to. So the jury can listen to him and say, yes, I think he carefully considered this, and I don't think the other doctor gave enough weight to these other factors, or whatever they might conclude.
Okay, so it goes to his mental state, his mental disorder. Does it go to the substantial risk of an offense?
Well, it certainly does to the extent that if it links back to one of the underlying diagnoses of antisocial personality disorder. Dr. Lodl said that people who have a paraphilia, which Dr. Doran found, who have a deviant sexual arousal pattern, which Dr. Doran found because he's sexually aroused to non-consent, that's the paraphilia, and who have antisocial personality disorder are at extremely high risk to reoffend sexually. Even Dr. Lodl, who didn't find that he had a paraphilia, found that he was at high risk not just to reoffend, not to just go out and do some, you know, penny ante burglary or theft or, you know, knock over a parking meter. No, he found that he was at high risk to reoffend sexually. So even his own expert doesn't deny that, even though he didn't find schizophrenia to be predisposing. And the only reason he didn't is because it predisposes him to lots of things, not just sexual things. And, you know, I think a jury could just, you know, not find that a very satisfying explanation.
Let's say it's relevant. Then you've got two other avenues. Even if it's relevant, you have to do the probative value, prejudicial effect. But also you go into this other category that you describe. Even though something is relevant, something can be relevant and be highly probative, but it's not admissible. So even if something is relevant, it can be knocked out because probative value, prejudicial effect. Even if something is relevant and can be knocked out because it's not in and of itself admissible. So if you are right on relevance, you're only halfway home.
Right, right.
You've got to be able to show that it's still admissible.
Well, I'm not sure I do in this case because this court didn't take an issue on that separately under as a hearsay issue. But obviously, if the court wants to reach that issue, you know, it can reach it. And, you know, while we would appreciate rebriefing on it, obviously that's up to the court. As to the probative value, the prejudicial effect and probative value, and I think Justice Judge, I forget who the third judge in the Court of Appeals was, but whoever pointed out that it's important that we make sure we always use the language of the statute, because we do tend, courts and litigators both sometimes tend to get a little sloppy with language. It's not just prejudice. It's not undue prejudice. It's not equal prejudice probative. It's that the probative value has to be substantially outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice. And that substantially is important because in State v. Speer, this case said If you're basically even, it comes in. And that, I think, you know, sometimes we forget that part of the analysis. Here, there was very little testimony that through the state's direct testimony of this agent. She mentioned that the kid was, when he was 15 and 16, he was in juvenile court and he was found uncontrollable. No details about what that uncontrollable was based on. Then she did describe the theft from the jewelry store and a battery to a girlfriend and two purse thefts, in which case he not only took the purse but also hit the victim once, punched her in the face, and another time hit her to get the purse or keep the purse. That's all the detail that came in. Then she talked about how many misconduct reports he had, 190-some in his time in prison, and characterized a group of them as disobeying, disrespect, some batteries, some threats, no detail except on the escape one. So the amount of detail and the egregiousness and the sort of horrendousness of it absolutely pales in comparison to the details of his prior sexual offenses and his predicate offenses and his attempted rape, which are not being contested here. So in terms of just sort of horrifying or sympathy of the jury or those kinds of prejudice things, there's no risk, certainly a substantial prejudice.
Well, what I get listening to your itemization is this guy is a really bad actor. He's had, was it three crimes that we're debating here?
Mm-hmm.
And he's got 90 plus offenses in prison. How long was he in prison?
Oh, boy. Off and on from 73 to, or 76 to 90s. Right. Late 90s, I believe.
Let's say it's 15 years. You divide 90 by 15, that's a lot per year. He is out of control. That's what I get from this. They may have been minor, but he is out of control. The fact that he's out of control, as the jury instructed, the fact that he's out of control and a bad boy, that's not enough to keep him in under 980. Jury told that?
They weren't told that in those words. They were told that they had to find some very specific things.
They weren't told just because he's a bad actor you can keep him in.
There was no request for that instruction.
No, okay. I'm just trying to find out what was said. So the jury is just told what the elements are, but not this factor. Well, I am not favorably predisposed to this man. I don't really want him out on the street, because whether it's a sexual offense or another offense, the chances are of a repeat conduct is high. Isn't that unfair prejudice?
I don't think it's unfair prejudice. I mean, I think that's the risk that the defense is concerned
right.
about. And obviously, if they were very concerned at trial about that risk, they could have asked for a limiting instruction, and we would.
What would the limiting instruction be?
Well, I think it could be similar to what you just said, that, you know, it is not sufficient for you to find him to be a sexually violent person to find that he is at a substantial probability that he will do some misconduct or some offense that may be of a non-sexual nature, something like that. In the 980 case, a little bit unlike, I mean, in a criminal trial, of course, you have to find specific elements. But in a 980 case, the elements you have to find are so tied to the sexual violent acts that I think it's really a stretch to think that a jury would find that his mental disorder predisposes him to engage in sexually violent acts and creates a substantial probability that he will do so because of these minor other offenses.
How do they know it's minor? Because you just said that they gave no description. Sounds pretty major to me, 90 plus.
Well, they're minor certainly compared to his sexual assaults, which is what, you know, the statute is concerned with. And the defense, to be fair, I mean, the defense brought out a great deal more about the conduct reports and the most disparaging things about Mr. Franklin in terms of his, you know, keeping fecal material in his room and urinating on his clothes and refusing to shower and drinking out of the toilet and all those things.
Did the jury know any of that?
Yes, they heard it all from the defense to show that that's part of his schizophrenic behavior, that for him these odd behaviors are part of his schizophrenia. So they heard a lot of very unpleasant things, but it didn't come into the state. And it was relevant to the diagnosis, because whether the jury ultimately finds a diagnosis predisposes or not, they first have to find there's a diagnosis of a disorder, and it went to that.
Counsel, if you were going to write this opinion, what does the state think this opinion should state?
I think this opinion should state, I think this opinion should state that other acts evidence admitted is admissible in Chapter 980 cases to prove a mental disorder that predisposes the person to engage in sexually violent conduct and or substantial probability to engage in sexually violent conduct, and that its admissibility is not limited by 90404 sub 2, because the first sentence of 90404 sub 2 says the starting point is it being shown to show that he acted in conformity therewith, and here it isn't. It's being offered to prove a current mental disorder and a future behavior. And really, the quote of, from Wright and Miller at, I think it's page 5 and 6 or 6 and 7 of our brief, I think is really, probably says it about as succinctly, certainly more succinctly than I have here, about the federal counterpart, which is one last point on the scope of Rule 404B. The general rule only bars the use of evidence of other crimes, acts, or wrongs to prove past conduct of the person. It refers to evidence offered to show the person acted in conformity with the posited character. Hence, the rule does not preclude the use of other incidents when the issue is the likelihood that the person will engage in certain conduct in the future. And I think that's it in a nutshell. It's not because it's not criminal. It's not because it's a 980. It's because of what it's being used for and what the prohibition is, and this simply doesn't fit within the language of the statute in the terms of the prohibition. I'd ask, also ask the court to say, nonetheless, then you just do the 90401 relevancy. And, you know, I think the Sullivan breaking down of relevancy into two component parts is very useful. Whatever evidence we're looking at is, does it go to a fact of consequence, and does it have any tendency to make that fact more or less probable? And if it does, it's admissible unless it's outweighed, the probative value is outweighed by the substantial risk of unfair prejudice. And then we believe that the other acts evidence in this case is relevant, admissible, and comes in. We would ask if the court is inclined to reach the separate issue of hearsay, since it wasn't in the petition for review, it wasn't raised in the Court of Appeals, or briefed thoroughly in this court, it's mentioned in the briefs, we certainly would be happy to submit short response or, you know, supplemental briefs on those issues as to why we think different pieces of evidence of the agent's testimony is admissible. We would prefer that the defense file a brief first so we know exactly what's being challenged, because it's not really clear in the record at this point.
Ms. Wellman, what I thought you would say in response to the Chief's question is that you would like this opinion to say that what's at issue here is not other crimes, wrongs, or acts evidence under 90404 in the first place. Because as I understand your argument, that's what you're saying. You're saying this evidence doesn't meet the definition of other crimes, wrongs, or acts evidence in 90404, and therefore it should be evaluated simply for its relevance under 90101 and the 90403 balancing test.
I guess
in other words, that it's...
I don't disagree with that, but it's because it doesn't fit that sentence, acted in conformity therewith.
Right, so right. It just doesn't fall within that statute.
Right. Right.
It's not other crimes, wrongs, or acts evidence under 90404.
Right, within
it's
the meaning of that statute.
Specific instances of conduct to prove character, because character is what's at issue.
Right. I don't disagree with that way of framing it either.
Is that the way you would... That's the way you started out your argument today, doing that, but then right. You ended up with saying it doesn't fit within the exclusion, and so therefore it's admissible.
I guess I see them as interchangeable, seeing that first sentence as the exclusion for that reason. It's excluded to show he acted in conformity. So.
Any other questions from Ms. Wellman? Thank you, counsel. Holly, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Just a few comments in response. Much of what I hear, I'm a little surprised at how much I agree with from the state and from the court. Obviously, the two extremes that you have here are one side would like to get as much of this evidence before.
So we just have to move your microphone.
Is that better?
Yep.
Thank you. Now I can't hear myself.
Well,
we're working
it's okay.
I was struck
You're
by
brilliant,
one.
If that helps. I don't know.
Thank you. I was struck by a question that Justice Prosser asked Ms. Wellman, and I heard what I thought was a concession that perhaps in some context at some point in time 90404 might apply in a 980 case. And I, quite frankly, I wish I had thought of the context with which Justice Prosser brought that up. The point being is I don't think there is one rule that fits all in this situation. That's why I believe the rules of evidence have to be applied across the board consistently as they exist now without a new rule that proclaims boldly that 90404 just does not apply in 980 cases generally.
Well, that gets to the question that I asked at the end of Ms. Wellman's argument. I don't see this case as presenting an issue of whether 90404 applies to Chapter 980 cases. I think it does. But whether this is 90404 evidence, in other words, does it meet the definition in the statute such that we have to go through the steps articulated for its admissibility under the statute?
I guess I would ask in response whether Justice Sykes believes that the length of the sentences that Mr. Franklin served any purpose for this jury in terms of getting to the elements of the offense. I would argue that that evidence is other acts evidence that should be subjected to a 90404 analysis in a 980 case. I agree that there are certain types of prior misconduct that is not fairly characterized as other acts evidence under 90404. And I believe I made that argument in my brief, that there are certain types of prior acts that come in under 90405, that they're directly related to the elements in the case. And my concern is here is that the opinion that comes out here, I'm not bold enough to propose what it should say, but the last case I argued up here, I believe Justice Abramson referred to it as the single-digit case. I have a concern that when I'm done with this case, this one will be referred to as the baby with the bathwater case, that because this is a 980 case, there's a different set of rules that apply. And I just don't think that can possibly be true in the context of 980 cases, because the facts that come before the court are so varied and so disparate that one rule doesn't fit all sets of circumstances in 980 cases. One thing I was particularly concerned about in the state's argument was the concession that neither doctor officially diagnosed Mr. Franklin with antisocial personality disorder. And the argument seemed to me to suggest that the fact finder could make that official diagnosis. I could not disagree more strongly with that assertion. That obviously is not an issue that's before this court.
Let me ask, when an expert testifies, isn't the expert required to say, I make this diagnosis to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty, or words to that effect? I mean, wouldn't they feel a little bit inhibited from making that diagnosis if they couldn't absolutely say that this behavior grew out of schizophrenia?
I'm sorry, I'm not following.
If they couldn't rule out schizophrenia with certainty, how could they say to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty it was an antisocial personality disorder? On the other hand, I don't think the jury necessarily is bound by that, are they?
They certainly aren't bound by the conclusion that the mental disorder does or does not make the person a sexually violent person. That ultimate conclusion is left to the finder of fact. Whether or not, in this case, we had competing opinions, and that's why we have experts. I don't think there was a third expert here, which would have been the fact finder. And what happened here is the fact finder was subjected to a situation where they had to make a decision between these two experts. Was this particular disorder a qualifying one, or wasn't it? And I'm left asking the question, what could have possibly turned the tide in this case? And certainly I would suggest to the court that the information that came in through Agent Kluwa may well have been that which convinced this jury that there was a qualifying disorder.
Thank you, Mr. Donnelly, and thank you, Ms. Wellman, for your arguments on this evidentiary case in 980 and the interplay of laws of evidence, rules of evidence in 980. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. The students would please remain here. Justice Crooks will be out momentarily, and everyone else is invited to stay for the discussion if you'd care to do so. We are in recess.